All right. Welcome, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Sandhill Road. And we all know that the internet today is a horrible place thanks to the many consent cookies. And today I have the person to thank for this. I'm just kidding. He's actually one guy who respects your privacy, who keeps your data clean and safe. Javad Stooley, who's the CTO and co-founder of Didomi, which is actually a pretty nice story, a French breakout SaaS company, which has just recently announced it's 40 million Series B, a really nice story of a bootstrap second time co-founder team. I'm really happy to have you here and dig into your founding journey.
Hi, Rasmus. Thanks for having me.
And maybe to kick things off, the very early days of Didomi, it was started 4 years ago, obviously coinciding with a major event, the European GDPR regulations coming into force, and you guys really being quite early to spot it. I think it was thanks to your prior startup. Talk a little bit about these early days and when you knew that you had to paddle hard to catch this wave.
Right. So I co-founded Didomi with Romain Gauthier, who's my co-founder there. We were both working together at MediaMath that acquired our previous company. And there I was focused principally on targeting questions, optimization questions in the context of the advertising industry. So I was working on things like fingerprinting, cross-device tracking, questions like that. So kind of the opposite of what privacy is to some extent. And working in the advertising industry, I think at the time it was 2016, 2017, is when we realized there was this big wave of privacy regulations and privacy demands from people coming up, and that would completely transform the whole industry. Advertising, obviously, but a lot of other industries as well. So we ended up leaving MediaMath early 2017. We decided to launch a new company in the privacy space. It was obviously not very clear to us what we wanted to do at the time. The first 6 to 9 months, maybe until the end of 2017, was discover and research, really. So we knew we wanted to build a product in the privacy space because of those regulations. GDPR would enter into effect in 2018, and we knew people's expectations were changing. But it wasn't clear to us what that meant from a product perspective, and there are multiple angles to approach a space like this. So at the end of 2017, after a lot of iterations, we ended up deciding to focus on consent and consent management, and on building technical solutions for developers to get in compliance with those consent requirements, which is usually a subset of GDPR, CCPA, and all the big privacy regulations. So the general idea at the time was to build Stripe for consent management, basically. That was the vision. And so it really started to pick up in early 2018. We saw things accelerating and coalescing in Europe, basically around GDPR. That's where I think the market really picked up at the time. And the advertising industry was one of the big drivers behind those changes as well, with the IABTCF and initiatives like that. So we decided to ride that wave and see what would come out of it. So we became the first, or one of the first, consent management platform, which is now more of a real software category, but that wasn't obviously clear at the time. And we went from about zero to 30K in monthly recurring revenue at the time in just a few months in April and May 2018. Basically right before and after GDPR got enforced.
That's quite impressive to have this traction. And I remember you were bootstrapped for the first part of your journey, which is obviously nothing that everybody can pull off. Talking about big challenges, you got sued by a US patent troll. It reminded me a little bit of the Silicon Valley episode with the patent troll.
But sadly, all the good music copyrights are gone.
That is so sad.
And that's why I moved into tech. And now I sue people like you.
What? So he's a patent troll?
Yep. Guys like him buy a ton of super broad IP from failed startups at auction and then threaten litigation against accused infringers, i.e.
It was a pretty dire situation for a while there, and you thought things were going to end, but I think which you handled brilliantly and where you came out alive, you didn't budge, you took it day by day.
I felt it pretty hard. I think, you know, so it happened very early in the adventure. I think late 2018 is more or less the first time we got served. I don't remember if it was a court or just the lawyers initially that basically said, you know, we have this patent that applies to exactly what you're doing, which was cookie notices at the time, and you have to pay us. I don't remember how much it was, but at the time for us, it was like a huge amount. And you know, as an entrepreneur, the lows are very low and the highs are very high. So that's why we do it. But the lows are so low. And so at the time, you know, you get served and you feel like it's the end of the world and there's nothing you can do against it. And you're not sure how to even move forward from there. there's also an element of justice with respect to patent trolls, which is you're this small European company with no US presence or very limited US presence, and you get served with by a patent troll that it will take, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars to defend against, even though you're surely, you have done absolutely nothing wrong. So there's an element of justice where no matter what you do is going to cost you a lot of money. And when you're this small and it's this early and you felt like it has just, you've just started and you just started to see some revenue, it feels very unfair to be in that situation. So that was the initial reaction is, you know, why is this even happening? Why should we care? And I don't want to have to deal with it. So, you know, you deal with that for a month or two, and that's just your personal feelings. And then you start thinking about what should we realistically do there. We weren't completely sure at the time, but, you know, it was just too much money to pay anyway. The settlement that they offered was too low. I think we countered with something lower and they just said no. So we decided that court was the only option at the time. We just went for it. You know, that was a little bit annoying for maybe 6 months because we had to get everything started. Then courts are not known to be particularly fast. Also, I think it definitely didn't necessarily help with fundraising at the time. But after maybe 6 to 9 months, we got things into order. We started to have, you know, a lawyer in place to counter the attack there. And what happened, what helped us tremendously was that very fast, I think, yeah, maybe less than a year after the first time we heard about it, we had a first court decision in New York that basically said that the whole lawsuit was to be dismissed because there was just no ground to it. And so we didn't even have to go into a real trial or anything like that. We got it dismissed, you know, before that even happened. And that was great because first it was obviously great news for us, really reduced the total amount of expenses we had to budget for that. And you just feel much better when that happens. Then that kept going for another 2 or 3 years through, you know, appeals and things like that. But the initial decision was just upheld the whole time. And we were, you know, growing fast and just getting to be a bigger company. So after a Series A, it wasn't really a problem anymore in our minds because we knew we had first a very solid legal argument that the whole thing was just empty. And second, at that point, we had money to deal with it. And it was a lot less personal and a lot easier to deal with. So definitely the first, you know, few weeks after that, at a size we were at the time, it's a very bad news. And it's kind of like a different, you know, you're used to dealing with problems every day. That's our job, but it's a different sort of problem. You know, it's one that doesn't get you closer to your objective of growing and becoming a bigger company. It's one that's just a roadblock that has no value and where someone is just trying to get free money from you. So, you know, it's a sort of racket that obviously you feel bad about as an entrepreneur. But I would say after 12 to 18 months, in our case, things ended up working out for the best for us. So now, you know, after 2-3 years after the initial problem, it's a pretty good story to tell. At the time, obviously, it wasn't a great thing to happen.
Yeah, no, I've been through a similar battle myself, so I know the dynamics, the David against Goliath dynamics. Yeah. Pretty much the worst side of patent trolls comes in the form of suing highly promising startups, so you were definitely a victim there, but I'm happy that you managed to survive it. And you obviously, as the CTO, you were in charge of building the first version of the product, the MVP. I think the first version was actually the consent cookie. You went out into the market, you got the first feedback. You started to see that you needed the consent analytics, which you built on top of it. But talk a little bit about this really scrappy first product you had.
Scrappy is a good way to describe it. So yeah, that was, you know, early 2018 with GDPR coming. And after iterating on a few products that we ended up not keeping over the years, we saw that cookie banners really is the way people see them today. Cookie banners was really the big topic in the space at the moment, cookie being one form of consent. It's a subset of the consent question. And so I think it was maybe January, February, where we started building a cookie banner because we started seeing demand in that space. And GDPR would get into effect 2-3 months later. So it was a pretty short time frame to get a real product in place, especially because what's always hard with this type of SDKs is you run on environments that you don't control. And contrary to building your own applications on mobile or web, where you control everything, here you're deployed in your client's websites or mobile apps, so you have no control over what's around you. So it's always a little bit hard to get that into place, especially in such a short time frame. So those few months were definitely a lot of hard work. I think what was interesting, or what I like to remember as the positive side of the experience, was I think April and May 2018 were like our two big months where we had a lot of clients coming in and we're building features as fast as we could to answer to their demands. because GDPR was rather around the corner or because they were a little bit late. And so I think for a month or two, I had like obviously very short nights, especially because I was in New York. Most of our clients were in Europe at the time. So a lot of problems would happen during my night. So I tended to shorten it a little bit. And so after I think a month or two of like this very, very active lifestyle, I hadn't synced up with Romain, my co-founder, for a while. And then we found a little bit of time to sync up. Basically told him about how much I had to work and how painful it was to have to build so much in such a short amount of time. And his answer, which was really fun, was basically saying, you know, it's exactly the same as sales side. I'm selling way faster than I can actually send the contracts out. That's the first time I discovered, you know, our revenue at the time was like 30K a month, when 2 months prior, it was mostly zero. And so from my perspective, that's the 2 months when everything happened. We got that first product out. It was crappy. I was ashamed. Like also, I think every sort of co-founder should be in the beginning. It was buggy. It was very technical. But we got a lot of the big publishers in Europe just with that, because there was almost no one else at the time focusing on the media industry. So it was actually very successful. And I think that's when you kind of know that, you know, when you're putting your customer through so much pain for adoption because of bugs, because of poor documentation, because it's so early in the product, but they're still there. They're paying and giving you time to fix issues because they have no other option. I think that's when you know you've got something. You don't know where it's going, but you know there's something there that needs to be investigated a little bit more. And so we decided to focus on this question of content management at that time. And so, you know, over a few months, we got consent notices or cookie banners on a lot of big European websites. And what became obvious after that, the first questions our clients would ask us would be, okay, I have my banner now, so I'm happy because I'm compliant, but how is it working? Like, are users say yes or no? What's the impact on my revenue, on my advertising revenue from that? So now ticks became this next natural question, just because we deployed the product and now people wanted to understand what it was doing for them on top of the purely compliance question. So we started building metrics around that. And I think overall, after the years, what you realize is the key metrics always the same, you know, because we work a lot, obviously with media, but also in the e-commerce space and so on. What's the impact on revenue? That's the final question everyone wants to know. And what you realize is that if you do your job correctly, you know, the impact can actually be positive. So by giving the choice for some people to say no, and by having the people who say yes be more valuable to you as users, you can actually get more overall revenue if you're doing your job correctly. So that was the first big insight that we started to build.
I think what differentiated you early on was that you have really this developer-centric platform with this open SDK. Maybe talk a little bit about how this set you apart early on already.
I think at the time, you know, we had there were already some companies building software in that space. And what we realized at the time, OneTrust, for instance, as I'm sure a competitor will talk about a lot today, but OneTrust was already there. You had TrustArc, you had a few companies out there at the time. What we noticed was that they were very focused on the legal approach to GDPR and privacy regulations generally. They had workflow management tools, compliance audit tools, and things like that, which I think is a real part of the market. But we realized those are more aimed towards privacy officers, lawyers, and this type of population. What was an entirely new space at the time was aiming those solutions at developers and building and giving developers an easier solution to get in compliance with regulation questions. And what was clear as well at the time was that a lot of those regulations actually transformed the way your products have to be built, as you know, in any industry you work on. You have to deal with your data differently, you have to store it differently, store it in different ways, stop putting it here or there, things like that. And so at the end of the day, even though those are legal questions, they put a lot of pressure on the product and engineering teams of any company out there. And what was clear at the time was that there was this big gap between what was offered and the very legal approach to those questions and what the actual product and engineering teams actually need, which is specific answers to their problems and as much as possible technical solutions to that. Their approach was really to build a platform that would help engineers answer those questions on their own, giving them a technical understanding of those legal requirements and giving them easy ways to put that into practice. So we ended up having basically like a SaaS platform with a lot of APIs to collect consent, store it, synchronize it with third parties, along with SDKs around that that give everyone an easy way of collecting consent wherever their users are. So a big part of what we build is making sure that wherever our clients need to be, we're there. So we have SDKs for web, mobile, connected TVs, and then all the declinations of that. So Flutter, React Native, things like that. We're also discussing with, for instance, car manufacturers on collecting content in cars and things like that. So wherever, you know, content needs to be collected, their job is to be there. And part of the platform is having all those SDKs to be
freely available to everyone wherever they build their own products, basically.
That's super interesting. And you mentioned before you went really hard into the media vertical in the beginning because you had some experience in this industry before. Tidome is a very sales-centric organization. I think there's double the headcounts in quota-carrying salespeople today than on the technical side. Once these early customers came in, how much hand-holding was there in terms of deployment? Was it pretty much a self-service solution?
Yeah, I think at the time, you know, when we started, it was not self-service. I would definitely not describe it as self-service. It was technically self-service in the sense that people could deploy everything by themselves. I don't think the first few months, I don't think anyone really did without our help. And it was a conjunction of us having to build a product so fast that there were a lot of those self-service features that were missing. And also the problems and being so new in the industry, being not so ready, that we needed to work through a lot of those questions with our clients directly. A lot of what we do is an integration job. So, you know, we get on the website and then we collect consent. But a lot of our work actually happens after that. When the user says yes or no, our job is to take that yes or no and make sure anyone on the website gets access to that and respects the user choice. So we go to the Google's APIs and we tell them that the user said no, for instance. But 3 years ago, there was no Google API. There wasn't a thing. And we had to find ways to communicate that correctly. So there were a lot of vendor interactions and integrations that were needed to be sorted out. So I think at the time, we needed to be very, you know, service-driven, I would say. There was a SaaS product, but it wasn't fully self-service in its deployment mode. And it's true that at the time, also, we were very sales-centric. I think that's still very true, that we're building a strong sales organization, and we see ourselves as serving big enterprise companies, which requires a strong sales organization behind it. I think today, as we're maturing, though, we are trying to shift away a little bit from the purely sales-centric, and we are investing a lot of our money into self-service, basically. And that's something we're seeing these days, where the people we hire will tend to be a little bit more on the product and the tech side, and we're slowly shifting the balance a little bit. And the key reason for us is an industrial one. Like 3 years ago, small websites, small, they had no reason to pay for GDPR. And so you had a very bimodal market where, you know, most of the market wouldn't pay a cent for privacy, maybe $5 a month, but nothing more than that. And then the only people who would really pay for that were your top publishers initially, and then slowly but surely the top retailers, and expand from there. And so I think 3-4 years ago, the self-service side of the business wouldn't have been that interesting from a sales or business perspective. And I think that has shifted a little bit over time because the industry has matured, because the rules are more and more clear. So now every company is slowly getting into the game. And because the rules are expanding in Europe, but also in the rest of the world, you see more enforcement and you see more regulations. And so the transformation of the company has to follow that. Being sales-driven is great when you have big publishers or big retailers, or big companies paying top dollars. When you're opening up the markets and when you want to look at different types of companies, you'll need to be a little bit more self-service there. So we're definitely a sales-driven organization. I don't think that that's changing anytime soon, but we want to make sure that that's in line with what the market requires. And the good news is we see the market opening up, which wasn't the case 3 or 4 years ago.
Yeah, I think that's super interesting how the market has matured, and this category, as you mentioned at the top of the show, didn't really exist. Maybe if I can double click a little bit on the product itself, and you mentioned, you alluded to it a little bit, you're not actually storing the user data on your servers. What you're storing is the consent, and then you're feeding it into all these APIs, into the Google API, but also on the client side, making sure that the way that they manage the data is compliant with GDPR. Talk a little bit about this thing that's going on in the back end that very few people are really aware of.
I think at a high level, consent management is pretty simple. So consent really is user choices. It's the fact that legally in Europe with GDPR, users can say yes or no to their personal data being collected for certain use cases, certain data processing. A very concrete example is cookies. A cookie is considered personal data. So setting a cookie on your computer in Europe, you have to say yes or no to that before it happens. But it can be other types of personal data, your geolocation, your IP, your unique user ID, things like that. And in Europe, we call it consent because it's more of an opt-in base where we have to ask you whether you agree or not before doing the data processing. But in the US with CCPA and even before CCPA, you had opt-out, which is really the same thing, except I can assume you say yes until you tell me you say no. So at a high level, consent management is really just collecting those user choices. So it's having different tools and different UIs for asking users those questions.
cookie banners are one type of consent, one type of questions we ask, but we have a lot of other products that deal with other types of consent. So for instance, subscription to newsletters or to any form of commercial communication is also consent. And so we'll have different types of UIs behind that. The first step in our job is collecting consent and making sure that it's clear and compliant how we do so. And some areas are very regulated. So what's a legal, what's a correctly formed cookie banner is actually pretty standardized and pretty regulated. So the exact text you put in there, the color of the buttons, the shape, things like that are actually pretty regulated. So first step of our job is collecting consent. Once that consent is collected, the second step obviously is making sure that it's respected because it's completely useless and non-compliant if we're just asking the user, but doing nothing with their choice. So once consent is collected, our job is to make sure that it is synchronized with all the potential third parties or even the client itself, so that they respect the user choice. And what happens there is indeed a lot of integration. So we'll take the user choice and start pushing it out to the vendors that could potentially be used for the data processing that we collected consent for. So if we take a very simple example, advertising today, so for showing an ad on a computer, a vendor might be tempted to use a lot of user data. So in this case, our job is take the consent, let the vendor know whether they can display advertising with personal data or not. And that comes, that's done through a lot of direct integrations, but it's also more of a spectrum. It's not a binary thing. So the one end of the spectrum is if the user says no, do nothing. So if the user says no, show no ads on the website. And that's what happened 3 years ago when there was no maturity in the market. The only thing we could do was block third-party vendors from doing anything. If the user said no, we would just not display ads. And then over time, what everyone realized is, you know, for users that say no, we can still do things. We just cannot use personal data. So we'll do non-targeted advertising. We'll do contextual advertising, things like that. So in this case, our job is to pass that no to those vendors so that they can do contextual advertising, for instance. And the way that synchronization happens also changes very often or very fast. In the advertising industry, you have what's called the TCF, Transparency and Consent Framework, which is the de facto standard for CMPs, content management platforms, to share the user status, the user choices with those advertising vendors. And so it's a technical specification that says how we as a company encode the user choice and how the vendors from the ad tech industry read that consent and interpret it. So the advertising industry actually did a great job there. The standard is very good, and most vendors, you know, enforce it and respect it the right way. And that didn't happen in the other industry. So slowly but surely, you see the big players catching up. So Google Analytics, for instance, or GTM, they added now APIs to be able to receive that consent information. And so our job is to keep adding those integrations to be able to push that out to those vendors. And very often, at least for the big players, it is custom integrations with every vendor. So that full chain from the first time as a user, you're being asked whether you agree to cookies or whether you agree to receiving emails, the consent collection side of the business, then it has to be fed into all those vendors, all those SaaS players usually that our clients work with. And that's a lot of integrations to build. So at an abstract level, it's pretty simple. Where it gets complicated is that there is no generalized standard for doing that with every single vendor out there. And so you have to build a lot of smaller integrations, either industry-based or just very specific to a given vendor together. And because it's a compliance question for our clients, they need to have all the integration for every single one of the vendor. You can't say I'm covering 80%, that's good enough. Good enough is not compliant, basically. So you have to cover everything. And a small, I think, interesting non-technical point is that that's also a key driver to less diversity in the market on the vendor side. So that's a topic maybe we can cover later. But because of that, because of CMPs having to build those integrations, you know, some players that are not correctly integrated will be driven out of the market eventually.
And it's super interesting. Given all these integrations, you alluded to this giving you defensibility within the market. You have very few customers actually switching CMPs over time, basically meaning that you have really strong cohorts, very little churn. And this, I think, in part has also allowed you to bootstrap the company for the first few years, put off raising the first institutional round for quite a while, bootstrapping it and scaling it really on the customer's money, which is a pretty impressive thing to do. Maybe talk about, you know, the bootstrapping journey until the first round of financing.
So we definitely have a very low churn, I would say, compared to a lot of our peers, not necessarily in the content space, but more generally in the SaaS. A B2B SaaS business. I like to think it's because our product is great, but I can't deny it. It's also because the there's an industrial effect to our business, which is once we're deployed and once your clients go through so much work, leaving is definitely a hard endeavor for them. It also means, you know, it's hard for us to acquire clients from our competitors. Eventually, that leads you to a more oligopolistic market where the strong players in the space have a lot of power. And so I think that's what's been driving our fundraises so far. When we bootstrapped, I think it wasn't clear to us at the time, you know, up until 2019, when you're in a business with such a low churn and with your competitors also having low churn, it does mean that, you know, you are in that B2B SaaS race where the ones who raise the most end up winning the market. And so when we're bootstrapping, I think we were at for our size, it was a great experience. It was a great achievement. What became clear to us pretty soon was that it would end at some point. It would be very hard to bootstrap a fully grown business on a market like this because of those strong tendency to a low churn. And so that's when we realized, okay, we need to start raising money. Otherwise, our competitors are going to do it. And we're going to end up being the losers there just because of that industry or market effect, not because we're doing a bad job or anything like that. I think Europe is picking up a little bit, and France in particular, the last couple of years in terms of building big companies. What was clear to us, though, at the time is that, you know, the odds are against you when you are a French player in a global market. Usually, French companies don't win in a market like this, at least in the tech space, to be clear. And so that also played a role in that we were able to bootstrap, didn't necessarily need to raise at the time, but we thought that, you know, that was the only way out of the European space for us was to also become a bigger player and to raise more money from VCs at that point. We also like to think that the big privacy wave started in Europe with GDPR. There is something to be said about the European player becoming one of the big players of the market. Because if we can't do it there, then really where can Europe do it in the tech space? So that was also part of the reflection there of us having a little bit of a specific position in terms of tech here, that privacy is a little bit more European than the rest. That also made us there. So, you know, we bootstrapped the first couple of years, and I think that worked great for us. We got to roughly $1 million in ARR without raising money from institutional investors. I think that worked well, and we just got to the point where we felt like we needed to get to the next level, and we needed to compete at a more international level. And so we started raising our Series A also more as a French round with French investors and continuing that logic in the second round in our Series B. We felt like we needed a more US-centric investor, and we worked with Elephant at that point so that we could become bigger in the US as well and start investing more in this country.
And how aggressive did you go out in the market for the first fundraising? Because, I mean, 1 million ARR SaaS company, I think it was close the first round in 2020, which was obviously a huge year for any SaaS company. I assume you would have had a couple of term sheets on the table. How broad of a fundraising was it? Or were you trying to keep it a lean and quick fundraising and wanted to really focus on growing the business mostly?
The Series A was actually pretty hard to raise. I would love to say that it was like that we raised millions in a few days in like an oversubscribed round. That's not really what happened. It was more like grit and perseverance for months. And Romain, my co-founder, did a great job there. At the time, I think what was a little bit against us, the revenue was great. And so as an opener to a VC in your first email or in your first contact with them, they'll definitely take the call. So we had a really easy time talking to VCs. We had a really hard time getting them to commit and invest. I think there were two factors there. The first one was we were still pretty deep in the publisher and media niche at the time. And so that put us more in the ad tech space for a lot of venture capitalists. And 2019 wasn't a good year for ad tech. Maybe today would be much easier. We see stronger performance from like Trade Desk and Criteo and things like that. At the time, ad tech was a losing bet. So that bias, I think, was against us. And also, I don't think it was clear at the time that it was a real market, or we had a hard time convincing our investors that it was a real market. It was right after GDPR, so they saw our metrics as, you know, having gone through a huge wave that was great. I don't think everyone was absolutely certain at the time that the growth was there to stay and that we were looking at the creation of a real category and not just like a very small niche space. What we've done since then, you know, is basically extending the market. So opening up to smaller companies, opening up to other questions than just cookies and things like that. So to us, it was clear that that would happen and that we started as this niche player because we needed to start somewhere. But the vision was clear to us. I don't think we were able to convince as many investors as we would have liked at the time. But we ended up convincing Briga, who was our first investor in that round. So, you know, they took the risk with us eventually. I think we're forever grateful for that. And I think they're pretty happy with their investment as well. But yeah, it wasn't as smooth as I think we would have expected either, given our revenue at the time. My feeling is that for the most part, you know, it's always a bet. And sometimes it's not clear where the niche is going. That was the hard part of the round at that time.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And to what extent do you think that many of these investors from the investor side, from the venture side, they perceived also the problem that you're solving as a very European-centric one? Obviously, you diving deep into GDPR, but you mentioned already there's similar legislations in the US, not quite the same. But how important was it that this is a broader category, that this is not just French logos that you can bring on? Talk a little bit about how this narrative was important also for the second round, for the Series B, the scale-up round that you just recently closed on.
That's a good point. So the Series B was, in comparison, much easier and much more fairy tale from an investment perspective. So, you know, we spent a couple of months preparing everything, and we already had at that point a lot of connections with investors, you know, which reach out regularly and that we would talk to regularly at that point. So we started a roadshow, and I think in about 2-3 weeks we got a few term sheets, and we ended up picking the best fit there. So I would say there was a lot less pushback. The question of whether it's a European question or not, I think, got kind of solved in between those two rounds, not initially by ourselves, but by the market itself. There was a push from regulations. So CCPA, Virginia has a law as well. So even in the US, we can see that starting to pick up a little bit. But there was a big global push for more regulation. So Canada, Brazil, Russia, China is coming up with regulation this year as well. So the question of whether it's a European or global question, I think, was answered by the market and by regulators pretty fast. And that definitely helped us not having to face too much of those questions anymore, too many of those questions anymore. So the Europe versus global, in my mind, is pretty much settled. It's a global question now. So we see it from regulators, we see it from users, we see it from big companies like Apple, for instance, that pushes GDPR-like requirements globally. We also see it from our clients. A lot of our clients, even when they are non-European companies and so they're not forced to apply GDPR globally, they very often decide to apply the most strict set of rules just because it's easier for them. And so a lot of our clients will decide to just go with GDPR everywhere. And that gives us, you know, CCPA for free and all the other regulations for free. So I think we actually went from it's a European question to having a European approach to it is a good answer to a global problem. So we actually kind of like turned that around in a nice way. And that definitely made the Series B much easier on top of, you know, just the growth of indeed the revenue and the logos. Because what we're also seeing in our client space is that in Europe, you know, all countries are fully invested in that. So we have a lot of clients in more than 15 countries in Europe, but we also see a lot of traction outside of Europe. So the US is also a pretty big market for us, but also get, you know, inbound from countries that we have no presence in whatsoever, like South Korea, for instance. And so you see both in your actual clients and in the demand you're getting that it comes from everywhere and that there doesn't seem to be any geographical limit to where privacy starts to matter and where content management starts to be important for companies, basically.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I mean, privacy is becoming such a huge topic. Obviously, me saying this as a European, and you've now just cleared the 40 million Series B. You mentioned that you're in the process of sort of scaling up, increasing the technical side. You're obviously now taking more of a managerial position where you have to manage a large tech team. Probably your typical day starts and ends on GitHub or GitLab, where you do source control, where you look at, you know, what different products are built out. Talk about, you know, your personal day-to-day life now in the scale-up mode.
So I would say less than GitLab or GitHub, but definitely spend more time in meetings than I used to. So I'm definitely transitioning from a role where, you know, 3 years ago, I was building most of the platform myself and then grew the team up to about 20 engineers today. So I've started to code less and less and to be less and less involved in the technical execution about a year ago, I think. And so I'm just continuing on that path of slowly moving towards a full management position. And so now the questions that I'm faced with are more about how do you grow a team? So how do you go from 5 a year ago to 20 today to 50 at the end of the year?
in a way that is sustainable from a culture perspective, so that people who've been here the longer and people who just joined all feel good and feel, you know, comfortable working with the company? How do you grow it from a tools and structure perspective and organizational perspective? So I spend a lot of time with engineering managers on this type of questions. You know, how do we hire? What's the hiring process? How do we train? How do we onboard? And then how do we execute? What's our usual process? How do we build everything? How do we automate everything? This type of question. So I'm, you know, I think at the end of that first transition to a full management role, which I'm comfortable with at this point, because indeed that's something I've done before at MediaMath, where I was managing a team of about 15 people at the time. And so I'm kind of like, you know, learning also as I go to get to a bigger team there. And then, you know, on a day-to-day basis, I would say, you know, the conclusion of that is that I indeed spend most of my time in meetings, whether it's internal ones. I also spend some time with partners or clients, which is also something I do pretty often. And so my life has transitioned to be a lot less exciting on a day-to-day basis, but I get a lot more support from the team today. So, you know, definitely lower stress than 3 years ago. And I start to get a little bit more time to focus on long-term questions and where the company should be going is something that I spend a lot more of my time on than I could do, you know, 3 years ago when I was the one building features day in and day out.
Yeah, talking about long-term questions, and when I talk with founders, they typically tell me what keeps them up at night is oftentimes competition, worrying about one competitor going into hyperscale mode, raising a $100 million round, you know, basically doing whatever it takes to get new logos. How is it for you? Is it a couple of peers that you're thinking about?
What happened 3-4 years ago was there was this big wave that we were part of, you know, new companies investing in the privacy space. A lot of them were obviously not working with consent, but a lot of them also went to the consent management questions. And so at the time, we had a lot more competitors, I would say, as an absolute number, but they were all pretty small. And what happened, I think, is pretty standard in SaaS industries nowadays is you have a first wave of consolidation that I personally think we're going through at the moment, that it could last another year or two, where you see out of all those companies that started 3 years ago, you'll have a few left that are strongly on a VC-funded path. And a lot of the others will just fall, either, you know, stop their product or just get acquired. So we're seeing a few small acquisitions like Cookiebot, for instance. And we're also starting to get a little bit more clarity on who are the strong VC-funded SaaS players in this industry. OneTrust is obviously the big one, bigger by far, I would say, much bigger than we are today. They've raised, I think, upward of $1 billion at this point, and they're still growing very fast. So very strong competitor. They also do, you know, they're also are focused on other verticals, not just consent. So we see them pretty often, and that has been a strong driver for motivation and growth, including in raising. You know, when you have competitors like that, you know that the only answer you can really give them in the long term needs, you need money to get there. You need cash to get there. And so when you're in the market like this, where the top 1, 2, 3 players are very strongly funded, you kind of have to do it too. Like you can't allow them to just get so much ahead that there's no way you're catching up. And I think that's very normalized today in SaaS, that this is how a lot of those markets evolve. So OneTrust is a big one. In Europe, I would say the one we'll also look at from time to time would be UserCentrix, because they're the European company that has raised the most after us. So we're also kind of like keeping an eye on them. Now there's, you know, I would say at least dozens of other potential competitors we're looking at, discussing with. And so, you know, that's what's driving us in the sense that we understand we can't let ourselves fall behind. And that's the positive aspect of competition. I think that's what stands out in the long term. You might have daily, you know, sometimes you're a little bit disappointed when they are able to achieve something you haven't been able to. But I would say in the long run, it's more a positive force than anything else. And the second thing we look at, I think, is more how the market structure is evolving due to external factors. And that's something that even OneTrust, as big as they are, they can control more than we can. And so a lot of us catching up and eventually getting to be stronger than they are, it comes from us reacting better to those external pressures. And on this industry, because it's changing very fast, there are a lot of those external pressures. There's regulation, obviously, that's changing pretty often. Even in Europe, GDPR, you know, was enforced or started to be enforced 3 years ago. But you see a lot of country-specific changes. So France, in April of this year, starting enforcing stronger rules. Italy will do so at the end of the year, Germany as well. So, you know, even existing markets that have existing regulations keep changing very fast. Like every year, you'll have new rules. So you need to keep adapting to that. You'll have big non-privacy related players, but that are driving the market structure. And we all know them. So that's Google, Apple, in our industry, that's the main two. So when Apple shows up and says, you know, here is how you collect consent from users for tracking, for instance, which they did with iOS 14 and what they call ATP, that puts pressure on you. What's the value of a CMP when Apple has a standardized ways of collecting consent? If Apple keeps investing in that direction, will our CMP on iOS, that's, you know, I don't know how much that is in revenue, but let's say that's 10% of our revenue, will that still be there in a year, 2 or 5 years? Some of the changes in the market would be cookies. You know, if cookies are going away, or third-party cookies are going away, what's the value of a CMP dedicated to cookies, for instance? So you have negative pressures. You also have positive pressure. You know, regulations are generally positive pressure, to be honest, from our perspective. They're negative to our clients, but they're positive to us because they bring a lot of revenue and demand. So we're looking at both market and competition as the two big trends. And our job, obviously, is to make sure that we're constantly adapting to that. The main conclusion we take and the main way we look at the market, and that it hasn't changed that much since the beginning, is that the long-term vision is around consent, and that remains true. What we should be careful about is limiting consent to a specific industrial question. So cookies is just one form of consent. Marketing communication is another form of consent. There's a lot of consent question in the healthcare industry, for instance, things like that. So our job is to keep expanding. We started as a niche French media focused company in terms of consent. Then we expanded in terms of industry, where now we're focused on a lot more than just media. So banking, retailers, insurance, things like that. And then you want to keep expanding geographically, the type of consents you manage and your product offering that goes with it. And our feeling is that, you know, today Apple might be a risk, but give it 5 years, if we do our job correctly, it's a small share of the overall question and the overall business eventually. And that's much stronger than, you know, us losing a deal against a OneTrust once in a while or things like that.
Absolutely. You highlight a couple of aspects that very few people think about when they click these cookie consents. So maybe as we're running against the clock here, Javed, a shout out to some of the great initiatives you're running at the company. First of all, obviously you're hiring, where you host events and webinars. Maybe talk a little bit about all these great things that the company's up to.
So we're hiring a lot in all functions, right? I think we're one of the companies that's hiring the fastest in our space. I think we're also structured in a way we're very remote. We have been remote since the beginning, so we hire people everywhere. You know, we just focus on getting good people to work with us wherever they're based. We'll work with them. And then, indeed, I think as we're growing and as we're maturing, we're focusing on a few things. So the first one is being a little more vocal about what we think is the right way to deal with privacy as a business. So you mentioned that comes through events. We're doing the Yes, We Trust Summit in October, you know, getting a lot of those thought leaders with us and discussing what does being privacy compliant mean for the tech side of the business, the product side, the marketing side, and how do you put all that together into making it not just a risk, but also like an asset. So investing in privacy, from our perspective, if you do it right, usually can have positive impact on your revenue. So we do events, we do a lot of, you know, blog posting, webinars with our clients, with our partners and things like that. And the key aspect to that for us is we think we know where the market is going. Like, we're strongly convinced that our vision of the market is the right one. We've been right so far. And the more we can explain that to everyone outside, the more we can go there, you know, all together. Most of what we've built so far is built with partners. We work with Google very closely. We work with, you know, a lot of others like that. And so we need to get everyone together. We need to get everyone in the same direction, basically building more privacy-focused features for our clients. And so the way we look at it, it's not a fight between companies. Companies and users. You know, there are a lot of local tensions where users want things that companies don't want to give them initially. But the long-term trend for us is pretty clear. Companies out there need to adapt basically to it. And the winners of tomorrow will be the ones that have strongly invested in privacy space. So we're building basically the platform to power all of that. And that's what we're hiring, because we've been growing very fast and we need to, you know, keep building our platform to support all those questions.
So yeah, Javed, thanks so much. I couldn't agree more with you and your great mission. Thanks so much for taking the time and walking us through the journey here. And every time I hit the consent form now, I will think of you and I'll be following your journey going forward.
Thanks a lot for having me.